Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Holbrook. First on this week's program, a story written by Noah Cullen and posted on the Phoenix New Times website on June 4th. Two Arizona groups are at war over the future of the Salt River horses. For decades, visitors and Arizonans alike have flocked to see a herd of wild horses that roam near the lower Salt River. Known as the Salt River horses, the animals are believed to have lived along the river in northeast Mesa for more than 100 years. They are iconic symbols of the West, beloved by everyone from nature photographers to those looking for a respite from the urban sprawl of Metro Phoenix. People come from all over the Tonto National Forest to watch their brown and splotchy white coats dipping into the water to find fresh eelgrass or to see a foal chasing after a mare. But just as the horses inspire passion, they also inspire passionate arguments. Some think the horses should be removed because they will eventually overgraze the land to the point where it cannot sustain them. Others want the horses left alone, with members carefully managed via fertility treatments. Arguments play out in court cases and Facebook groups, each side suspecting the motives of the other. One such argument between the group that currently manages the wild horse population and another that would like to take over that responsibility has been roiling for months. The fight has gotten nasty, and both groups say the future of the Salt River horses and Arizonans' ability to enjoy them is on the line. The group that currently manages the horses is the nonprofit Salt River Wild Horse Management Group, and it has a lot of supporters. On Facebook, 174,000 people follow the group, which consists mainly of volunteers who tend to the horse population and is led by Simone Netherlands. An additional Facebook group, the 93,000 follower Salt River Wild Horses Advocates Group, largely parrots the talking points of the first. But a much smaller group has been training its fire on the Salt River Wild Horse Management Group. Dubbed the Wild Horse Transition Team, the group is run by professor and historian John Mack and U.S. Forest Service contractor Jacqueline Hughes. It has only 232 members, though a related Facebook group has 3,000 followers. Between them, the groups are harshly critical of the current management group, claiming the group isn't open to opposing ideas, risks damaging the environment by letting the horses overgraze, and isn't transparent about how it spends money. The Salt River Wild Horse Management Group's current contract expires in July, as the Department of Agriculture begins considering who should manage the horses going forward. The feud between the two horse-loving factions has reached a fever pitch. Both are competing for the next contract to manage the horses, and both think the other will imperil the horses and perhaps the environment with their plans. Meanwhile, the Department of Agriculture has sent signals that it is prepared to change horses midstream, moving away from Netherlands Group and adopting a management plan more aligned with Mack and Hughes, but that Netherlands finds problematic. The fate of the Valley's beloved wild horses hangs in the balance. Changing horses. As best as anyone knows, the Salt River horses have been there for centuries. The horses are not technically native to Arizona. Horses that once lived in the Americas were extinct thousands of years ago before being reintroduced by Spanish colonizers in the late 15th century. But they've certainly been here longer than most transplants. Most estimates trace their origin to the Italian missionary Father Eusebio Kino, who established a series of missions in Arizona in 1691. By 1890, the Arizona Champion newspaper referred to the horses as native stock. It wasn't until 2016, though, that the Salt River horses enjoyed special protection. That year, then-Governor Doug Ducey signed the Salt River Horses Act, which states the horses are not stray animals and that no one can take, chase, capture, or euthanize a horse without approval from the Arizona Department of Agriculture or the county sheriff. A horse may only be removed for humane purposes, such as if they're old or injured. Every 5 years, the Arizona Department of Agriculture grants approval for a group to manage the roughly 280 horses now living on the river. The contract is a $0 deal, meaning interested groups must fund their own efforts. That bidding process began again this year, though the department recently canceled the bidding because of unauthorized conversations that allegedly violate state law. Netherlands said she thinks every bidder broke those rules, her group included. The department said that it will soon start the process over, and Netherlands expects four organizations to bid for the contract. When it does, the Salt River Wild Horse Management Group will apply to renew its contract. However, the group isn't hopeful of success. The Department of Agriculture is asking interested groups to submit proposals that adhere to a new provision to remove three adult horses via adoption for every foal born into the herd. To Netherlands, who is the president of the Salt River Wild Horse Management Group, such an approach is anathema to her beliefs about how the herd should be managed. Her group has managed the horses through a fertility program. Volunteers dart mares with PCP, a drug that prevents pregnancy, ensuring that natural deaths outnumber births every year. According to the group's numbers, they have taken the population from 463 horses in 2019 to 280 now, without taking any horses from the herd. The group is well on its way to thinning the herd to between 100 and 200 horses by 2030, as laid out in an Agriculture Department control plan in 2020. We have proven that wild horses can be humanely managed without removing a single horse, Netherlands said. But with the Agriculture Department's new 3-for-1 requirement, Netherlands doesn't expect that track record to get her group very far as it seeks to renew its contract. Applicants will be stating their population goal, and Netherlands fears that the contract might go to whichever group intends to lead the fewest. Though she wouldn't say what numbers her group will submit, she knows it'll have to be lower than they'd like to have a chance. She said the department intends to leave only 100 horses on the river, which she doesn't think is a viable number. I know that if we write 200 horses in our proposal, that we will not get hired, she said. Bad blood. The group much more aligned with the department's new guidelines is the one led by Mack and Hughes, whom Netherlands regards with intense skepticism. Mack told Phoenix New Times that the 3-for-1 provision is not something I would have done, but Netherlands fears the Mack and Hughes-led group would take advantage of it by allowing more foals to be born so that three corresponding adult horses could be removed and auctioned. Hughes did not respond to her request for comment. That suspicion is informed by some shared history. Netherlands is familiar with Hughes, who is a former U.S. Forest Service contractor who played an alleged role in the removal of the alpine wild horses in the Apache Sitgreaves National Forest in the White Mountains in 2022. The Forest Service claimed the wild horses were contributing to habitat damage for the native species, though many wild horse advocates dispute that phenomenon and insist the horses are native to the land. The Forest Service hired Hughes' company, Rail Lazy H, to facilitate the removal and sell the horses at auctions in Texas, which requires them to be classified as unauthorized livestock. Netherlands, and other wild horse advocates fear that when these horses are sold at auctions, they are at risk of being sold for slaughter. Netherlands and others from her group tried to bid for the horses in online auctions, but were prevented from participating. Last July, Salt River Wild Horse Management Group and the group American Wild Horse Conservation teamed to sue the Forest Service and the Arizona Department of Agriculture over the issue, claiming the two government agencies failed to provide an adequate 15-day notice of the sales. The groups also accused Hughes Company of self-dealing, shill bidding, which is when a seller bids to increase the price at auction, and said the company has worked for personal gain at the expense of the Forest Service. At the time of its complaint, the Salt River Wild Horse Management Group said it had found homes for 392 of the Alpine wild horses. As of May 19th, the Forest Service and the Arizona Department of Agriculture were seeking to get the lawsuit dismissed. Netherlands fears the same thing will happen with the Salt River horses, and she thinks Max and Hughes groups see money in selling them. "It's all a giant big scheme against these horses," she said. "They are not fighting for the well-being of these horses. They are fighting for a nice, lucrative way to breed horses and have a constant stream." The Agriculture Department bidding process prevents her from expressing such concerns to anyone at the department, so she has been making her case as loudly as possible elsewhere. She said she's spoken to state legislators on both sides of the aisle and with staffers of Governor Katie Hobbs. She's also asked the Attorney General's office about the legality of the three-for-one provision. The Attorney General's office declined to comment to New Times. The Governor's office did not respond. The public of Arizona thinks these horses are safe because they have a bill that protects them, Netherlands said. Should they hire Jackie Hughes, that would literally be a mockery of the bill. It would be a decision without any compassion at all, and it would be a decision that would be the end of the Salt River Wild Horses. Arrival perspective. As one might expect, John Mack disputes Netherlands' characterization. As a Fountain Hills resident and a history professor who teaches an online course at Georgia State University Perimeter College, he certainly didn't expect to become this intimately involved with wild horses in Arizona. His wife is a wildlife photographer, and the two of them traveled to photograph and research wild horse herds for a book about the history of free-roaming horses in the West. During those travels, the Salt River herd stood out, in a bad way. It became clear to us that what you're seeing at the Salt River is not what you see when you travel around the country and look at all the free-roaming wild horse herds, Mack said. Mack became concerned about how the herd was being managed and decided that there needed to be an alternative. Then, the Agriculture Department opened its since canceled but soon to be reopened bidding process. On May 5th, Mack announced his intention to try for the contract managing the herd alongside Hughes. In a press release about his decision, he said he took seriously the many accusations and allegations I've seen circulated about Jackie Hughes, but that he was comfortable teaming with her. "I've conducted my own independent investigation. I reviewed public records, communications, and statements made by all parties involved," Mack wrote. "Based on the evidence, I am convinced that these attacks are based on lies, half-truths, innuendo, and emotionally charged narratives." Mack has three main beefs with how the Salt River horses have been managed. He said the Salt River Wild Horse Management Group doesn't play well with others, and he questions how the group manages its money. He also thinks the horses are causing environmental damage, which he said is based on well-established ecological principles, direct field observations, and scientific studies. He said, rangeland scientists and wildlife biologists have documented loss of native vegetation, soil compaction, and damage to young cottonwood and mesquite trees in areas of concentrated horse activity. Netherlands and American Wild Horse Conservation have disputed that conclusion. They say environmental damage mostly comes from humans, and that the horses, which have been grazing on the land for centuries, are, quote, scapegoats. There are no scientific data published in any peer-reviewed journal about the Salt River wild horses or the lower Salt River habitat, American Wild Horse Conservation wrote on its website. Neither the U.S. Forest Service nor any other organizations have performed a scientific study or overall environmental assessment of the lower Salt River, indicating that there have not been serious environmental concerns on the lower Salt River to date. Netherlands Group also rejected a 2025 forage assessment study from the University of Arizona that found that the Salt River Horse Management Area did not provide an adequate supply of food necessary for the horses. In a Facebook post, the Salt River Wild Horse Management Group claimed the study is based on unverified, non-peer-reviewed data that dramatically overstates forage needs of wild horses and ignores natural climate cycles. But Jacob Hennig, an assistant professor at the University of Arizona's School of Natural Resources and the Environment, says there's some truth to the notion, but wild horses can negatively affect the environment. Wild horses can, if they're allowed to, lead to ecological degradation, said Hennig, who works with wild horses around Arizona, but not the Salt River horses specifically. Horses eat more, which can limit regrowth. Climate change may make things worse. Especially in the Southwest, we're getting more arid and hotter each year, he said. That combined with overgrazing can really be challenging and can lead to some unintended and unwanted consequences. What's next? With the bidding process starting over, it's hard to forecast what will happen with the horses. Max said that if another group besides Max wins the contract, except the one led by Netherlands, it seems, he would offer his support. I'm not a scientist. I don't know what that looks like, Max said. I'm a process guy. I know how things should be done, and I'm really good at getting the right people in the room. One thing that's certain is that Netherlands Group and the one led by Mac and Hughes harbor a deep distrust for each other. What also seems to be true is that both care deeply about the fate of the horses, at least enough to argue endlessly about it on social media. Whoever takes over managing the beloved Salt River horses will be signing up to not only handle the herd, but also to suffer the slings and arrows of passionate detractors. We have to find a way to work together, Max said, if that's even possible. The valley's homeless population went up again. It may get even worse. This next story was written by T.J. LeHeru and was posted on June 3rd. For 1 year, it looked like the valley was making real progress in curbing homelessness. Then 2025 hit. On Friday, the Maricopa Association of Governments released data from its annual one-day count of unhoused people in the Phoenix metropolitan area, known as the point-in-time count. The PIT count is meant to give a snapshot of homelessness in the valley, provide more details about the unhoused community's demographics, and allow local governments to apply for funding from federal homeless assistance programs. The count was conducted on January 28th, during which officials and volunteers counted 9,734 people experiencing homelessness across the valley. That's a 3% increase from 2024, when the count found 9,435 unhoused people, a year-over-year decrease. The 2025 total is also roughly 100 people more than the 2023 total, meaning the valley completely reversed any gains it made last year. That's concerning, but not the most concerning thing the count uncovered. Last year, for the first time since the PIT count began, there were far more unhoused people who were sheltered, essentially who had a roofed place to rest their heads at night, than who were unsheltered. This year, though, those ratios reversed themselves, with the number of unsheltered people jumping 28%. While there were a little more than 4,000 unsheltered people in 2024, there were close to 5,000 this year. That suggests the progress made in 2024 was an aberration. Brian Gruters, the Regional Homelessness Program Manager for MAG, who led the PIT count, noted that the 2025 numbers are very much in line with preceding years, last year excepted. If you took 2024 out, this year's count wouldn't come as much of a surprise to anyone, Gruters said in a phone interview with Phoenix New Times. We just had a really good year in 2024, and last year we didn't. Why was the Valley's progress erased? In a press release, Phoenix Office of Homelessness Solutions Director Rachel Milne pointed to the expiration of federal funding, specifically funding from the Joe Biden-backed American Rescue Plan Act of 2021. As a result, 1,000 shelter beds are no longer in use in the Valley, a number that closely mirrors the increase in unsheltered people in the PIT count. Those funds did a lot for our community. They helped us design new ways to house and serve our unsheltered neighbors. They provided supportive services for seniors, families, and individuals to help end their homelessness. And they allowed us to increase the number of shelter beds available to provide a safe indoor space for thousands of people in need, Milne wrote. We will continue to seek local, state, and federal funding to ensure that we can help prevent and end homelessness in our community. Worse ahead? Though the count technically took place during the early days of President Donald Trump's administration, any cuts Trump made in his first week in office wouldn't have affected the conditions on the ground that quickly. But that doesn't mean that they won't affect things going forward. Gruters and other officials suspect things could get worse with the Trump administration looking to scale back government spending. I think that's got everybody a little bit concerned about what we might see down the line, Gruters said. That number of resources, like shelters, has been declining, and that's a major concern. The problem is likely worse than the PIT count total even suggests. The nonpartisan think tank Grand Canyon Institute believes that, by nature, the PIT count is vulnerable to chronic undercounting. Dave Wells, the Institute's research director and an advocate for the unhoused, told New Times that GCI surveyed people the day of the count at an Aris Foundation meal for the homeless. The Institute found that most of the people who said they slept on the street had not been counted. While the official count found 306 unsheltered people in Tempe, the second most behind Phoenix, Wells and GCI estimate the real number may be more than 700 people. Unsheltered people are systematically undercounted by the point-in-time survey, the Institute wrote in a policy brief. The point-in-time survey does tell us a great deal about the people who were surveyed, as many important questions were asked. We just should not expect that the census is accurate, especially as it relates to people who are unsheltered. That conclusion doesn't surprise Gruters. The count cannot be 100% accurate. It's a best guess. It's an imperfect database, Gruters said. By definition, it's a point in time, rather than a comprehensive look at the flow of people in and out of homelessness. We tend to look at the PIT count as a minimum count. We can't get everyone in one day. Undercounting or not, the number of unhoused people has gone up, and that's an especially troubling trend as the summer approaches. The last two summers in the valley have seen an unsettling spike in heat-related deaths, with 1,253 people dying from heat-related causes over those 2 years. About half of those who died were living on the streets. Now, those people may have fewer places to go. The Valley lost 1,000 shelter beds, and Tempe changed the rules it uses to approve cooling centers, denying approval to several that operated last year and therefore gave unhoused residents fewer places to seek refuge from the heat. On top of that, this summer is forecast to be hotter than normal, though perhaps not as hot as the last two record-breaking years. We could have a lot more than 600 people perish this summer, Wells said. A map of the valley's cooling centers, in some cases the absolute last barrier keeping the unhoused from death in extreme heat, can be found on MAG's website. Remember that if you missed any of the stories in this program, or any other Sun Sounds program, you can listen to them on demand. Just go to sunsounds.org and click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then, click on On Demand Podcasts, scroll down to the program you're interested in, and click on Listen. Next, a story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on June 3rd. Millionaires are flocking to this valley city in droves. Over the last 10 years, millionaires have been flocking to one Arizona city. It's become so popular among the wealthy that, over the last decade, only one other city in the world has seen a bigger increase in its number of millionaire residents. Have an Arizona city in mind? Yes, it's Scottsdale. From 2014 to 2024, the number of millionaires in Scottsdale has grown by 125%, according to a study by the investment company Henley & Partners. Only Shenzhen, China, has increased its millionaire population by a higher percentage. What's driving this millionaire growth in Scottsdale? Real estate agents who have that kind of deep-pocketed clientele attribute the phenomenon to warm weather, strong tax benefits, restaurants, shopping, and a strong entrepreneurial spirit. The city, as well as its neighbor Paradise Valley, also markets itself as the playground and home base of the well-off. We have abundant sunshine, luxury golf courses, upscale shopping, and really great fine dining experiences, said Tiffany Carlson Richeson, a Scottsdale-based realtor. The lifestyle appeals to wealthy individuals. It's an absolutely amazing place to live. If you're rich, that is. Scottsdale consistently ranks among the most expensive places to live in the valley, and it has a NIMBYist allergy to building apartments, which tend to be rented by those from lower income brackets. I don't think we need to have housing that houses absolutely everybody, Mayor Lisa Borowski told KJAZ before she took office. According to the study, roughly 14,800 of the 240,000 people who live in Scottsdale are millionaires, or a little more than 6%. Much of the rising millionaire population can probably be attributed to transplants, not regular Scottsdale residents who hit it big, but millionaires who moved to Scottsdale for the weather or to retire. There are so many luxury, high-end, and high-quality ways to spend your time. said Scottsdale real estate agent John Gluck, which is very attractive to people who have money. While Scottsdale is not cheap by any means, it has also drawn millionaires from California, with the state's very reasonable flat income tax, Gluck said. Arizona doesn't penalize you for making more money, he added. Carlson Richardson said wealthy individuals are also drawn to other policies in the state, such as school choice and empowerment scholarship accounts, which, it should be noted, are supposed to help lower-income families send their kids to better schools. But it isn't just rich Californians who are flocking to Scottsdale. They're coming from all over. Carlson Richardson has worked with clients looking to move from Oregon, Washington, and Hawaii, as well as Canadians looking for a second home for the winter. Gluck said that he's worked with millionaires from places like Seattle and New York who've decided to retire in Scottsdale. It used to be a more popular contest between Florida and Scottsdale for retirees, Gluck said. But due to an influx of tropical storms in recent years and the expensive insurance that comes with it, retirees have been leaning toward Scottsdale. Absent from recurring natural disasters outside of extreme heat, the city has also welcomed Californians whose homes were destroyed by wildfires. And while most of Scottsdale's millionaires brought their wealth from another place, the city has also become a breeding ground for wannabe millionaires. People are very encouraging of entrepreneurship, Gluck said, pointing to many Scottsdale-based entrepreneurs in the remote self-development coaching world. This spirit of the place is very entrepreneurial and positive. Carlson Richardson also believes that the Scottsdale cities of Gilbert and Queen Creek could soon be on this list. Both cities, especially Queen Creek, have seen an influx of millionaires move there. But for now, Scottsdale remains the only Arizona city among the 27 on Henley & Partners' list. Here are the five cities that have added millionaires at the highest rate since 2014. Number one, Shenzhen, China, with a millionaire growth of 142%. Number two, Scottsdale, millionaire growth 125%. Number three, Bengaluru, India, with millionaire growth of 120%. Number four, West Palm Beach, Florida, with millionaire growth of 112%. And Hangzhou, China, millionaire growth of 108%. Ansari makes surprise visit to ICE prison, returns with horror stories. This next story was written by Morgan Fisher and posted on June 2nd. Editor's note, originally published May 29th, this story was updated June 2nd to include a lengthy response from Immigration and Customs Enforcement. On an overcast Thursday morning in south-central Arizona, Jose Camacho pulled his car over behind a stop sign, stepped out, and lit a cigarette. If there was ever a time for a smoke, it was now. Camacho had just left a Department of Homeland Security detention center in the rural Pinal County town of Eloy, where his wife of 21 years has been held for the last 3 months. She'd been scooped up by Immigration and Customs Enforcement and had vanished without a trace. Camacho had only learned where his wife was because she'd been able to mail him a letter using paper, a stamp, and an envelope that a deported detainee had left behind. "This is my only shot," the letter read. Camacho's wife, Velma Villalobos, first came to the country from Mexico when she was 2 weeks old. Now 37, she'd spent her entire life in the U.S. In 2004, she married Camacho, who is a U.S. citizen. Together, they have four kids ranging from 15 to 20 years old, all American citizens as well. She doesn't even speak Spanish. Yet Villalobos was still undocumented. Camacho had attempted to get her a green card years ago, but was dismayed by the immigration system and gave up. And now, with the Trump administration looking to get its hands on any immigrant it can find in order to fulfill the president's promises of mass deportations, Villalobos was sitting in an ICE facility. Stories like Villalobos's prompted Democratic Representative Yasemin Ansari to make a surprise visit to the detention facility Thursday afternoon. After a three-hour tour, during which reporters could not accompany her, the freshman congresswoman said she heard many more stories like Villalobos's that were extremely alarming. "That should never be happening," she said. "I will be focused on calling attention to this and looking at how we can push the administration to do better." Alarming stories. When ICE takes someone into custody in Arizona, perhaps in a neighborhood raid, or after some legal shenanigans outside an immigration court, the Eloy Detention Center is often where they end up. The facility is owned and operated by the private prison group CoreCivic. It's doing big business these days. The Eloy facility has nearly reached its capacity, with more than 1,500 detainees currently held there. The prison is also notorious. A 2019 report by Puente and the Advancement Project called it one of the deadliest ICE facilities in the country. So far this year, two detainees have died there. This is a detention center largely for people who have not committed any crimes other than trying to come to the United States, Ansari said. But when you go inside, it is a prison. You are effectively in a prison. As a member of Congress, Ansari has a right to enter. For the purpose of conducting oversight, any facility operated by or for the Department of Homeland Security used to detain or otherwise house aliens. She exercised that right Thursday, receiving a tour that started a little before 11 a.m. and ended shortly after 2 p.m. Ansari said an ICE official guided her throughout and took as much time as needed to answer questions and give us a proper tour of the entire facility. Ansari and her deputy director, Maria Lopez, were shown the center's medical facilities, housing areas, library, recreation area, and eventually the eating facilities. But while the Phoenix Democrat said she was grateful for the transparency that the staff showed me, she said staffers' responses were very diplomatic, and detainees painted a bleak picture of the conditions at the facility. Through Lopez, who speaks Spanish, Ansari was able to speak directly to detainees, who flocked to speak to her in the facility's eating area. She said she spoke to about 15 women for roughly 45 minutes, and the stories they told were alarming. Since we were in the room, the atmosphere at lunch was much different than it usually is, Ansari said the women told her. Typically, they're being yelled at, they're being rushed, they're being demeaned. Ansari said the women told her about a guard. They pointed to this gentleman in the lunchroom, Ansari said, who forced around 50 of the women to get up during their lunch and walk around the facility's yard. This continued for more than 2 hours in the heat and without water, as the guards yelled degrading remarks at the women. The women told Ansari that at least one detainee passed out from the heat, and one detainee told Ansari that a guard told the marching women, "This is the price of the American dream." That was just a blatant attempt to embarrass these women, to harass them, Ansari said. There was no reason for it. Ansari was also told about a fire that occurred at the facility on May 5th. The staff were very ill-prepared to evacuate people, she said, and was told that an 80-year-old woman was trapped and pounded on a door trying to get out before fainting. Another detainee trying to help her was punished with 15 days of isolation, Ansari said. To me, this is sickening, Ansari said. It's jaw-dropping. Ansari also told stories of inadequate drinking water, dehumanizing behavior of guards toward detainees, including crass and racist language, and a lack of air conditioning. Lopez added that at other times the air conditioning would be so cold that the detainees could feel their bones. Detainees who wanted to report the abuse faced roadblocks. Ansari said accountability measures, such as an ombudsman and a phone system, were disabled. Phoenix New Times emailed questions to ICE about the allegations, but did not immediately receive a response. Pushing for change. Since taking office in January, Ansari has been a persistent voice in Congress pushing back against the Trump administration's immigration policies. She traveled to El Salvador in April in an unsuccessful attempt to meet with deported Maryland father Kilmar Abrego Garcia, who was mistakenly sent to a terrorist prison in the country. After Thursday's visit, her office plans to articulate the concerns from these women directly to the highest levels at ICE and to this administration, she said. Given that the Trump administration hardly seems ashamed of its draconian approach to immigration, it's anyone's guess how effective that'll be. But Ansari says she'll keep raising a stink about it. Any change Ansari could spur would help Camacho. He was also at the Eloy Detention Center on Thursday, though not as a guest of Ansari. He was there for his wife's court date at the facility. It was the first time they'd seen each other since she was detained, and decided to wander over when he saw a group of reporters. Ansari doesn't think she spoke to Villalobos, but she still had more access to Camacho's spouse than he did. Though they locked eyes in the courtroom, they were not able to speak to each other. If your family is in here, you might as well be in here too, Camacho told reporters on the sidewalk outside of the facility. Villalobos' next court date is in September. Unless something changes, it promises to be a harrowingly silent 4 months for Camacho. If the stories Ansari heard were indicative, it'll be far worse for Villalobos. It's rigged against the family and against the people that are in there. It's rigged against them, Camacho said. It's very rough, very difficult to have a person in this facility. ICE responds. Friday evening, ICE spokesperson Fernando X. Burgos Ortiz sent the following statement in response to Ansari's comments. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement appreciates the opportunity for engagement during the recent unscheduled visit by the Congresswoman Yasemin Ansari on May 29th to the Eloy Detention Center. ICE is surprised by the derogatory comments made by the Congresswoman following her visit, especially since she expressed gratitude to staff for accommodating her and made no remarks during or after the visit indicating any concerns. ICE emphatically denies the allegations regarding the treatment of detainees, including claims that women are being marched around outside in the heat, causing a woman to faint, or that they are not provided potable water, or that the air conditioning is ever turned off as a form of retaliation. Further, the Congresswoman relayed to media that 50 women filed complaints about a month ago, yet upon a thorough review of our records, no such complaints were actually filed. It's easy to relay one side of the story, but true journalism would reveal the facts. ICE remains committed to providing comprehensive medical care to individuals in its custody, including medical, dental, and mental health intake screenings, conducted within 12 hours of arrival, followed by a full health assessment within 14 days. The agency ensures access to medical appointments and 24-hour emergency care, with no detainee denied emergency care at any time. On May 5th, at 4:06 a.m., ICE evaluated officers, employees, and detainees from the Eloy Detention Center due to an electrical issue with a microwave. As a precaution, everyone was moved to the recreation yard for 30 minutes. After staff resolved the issue, all individuals returned to the unit by 4:36 a.m. During this evacuation, a detainee collapsed in the recreation yard and was transported to Banner Casa Grande Medical Center for further evaluation May 5th. She was discharged from the hospital on May 7th and subsequently released from custody on May 10th. ICE takes all allegations of misconduct seriously and requires time to research specific details, including dates and names, to investigate claims effectively. It's easy to allege misconduct by those working at the detention facility, but when given the opportunity to provide specific details regarding the allegations, none were provided by those who are asking ICE to disprove the Congresswoman's unsubstantiated allegations. Nationwide, detainees have access to the ICE Communication Services free call platform, which connects them with pro bono legal services and providers should they choose to use this service. As a law enforcement agency, ICE expects all employees to uphold the highest standards of professional conduct. The agency encourages anyone with information regarding specific incidents to report it to the DHS Office of Inspector General at 800-323-8603 or the ICE Office of Professional Responsibility at 833-442-3677. Complaints regarding detention facilities can be reported to the Detention Reporting and Information Line at 888-351-4024, where trained operators are available to assist. The reality is that these accusations do not reflect ICE's policies or practices. Detainees are treated humanely, and while in detention, are afforded recreation, medical care, and nutritionist-approved meals. The program continues now with this story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on June 6th. Why is a historic home near Roosevelt Row being relocated 12 feet? If you've driven along 3rd Avenue in downtown Phoenix recently, or perhaps took a stroll after checking out Proof Bread's new location, you may have noticed a boarded-up red brick home elevated on steel beams and what looked to be wooden crates. Surrounded by modern apartment buildings and well-kept law offices, the home sticks out like a sore thumb. So, what's up with the building? And literally, why is it up, sitting several feet off the ground? Phoenix New Times has the answers. The home is known as the Sergeant Oldacre home. Built in 1909, the house was once home to Elizabeth Oldacre, a prominent historian in the city. The brick craftsman bungalow is listed in the National Register of Historic Places in Phoenix and has been a staple of the Roosevelt Row district for decades. However, the home was slated for demolition before being saved from the scrap pile in 2024 by Live Forward Development, a Phoenix-based developer that received a city grant to help preserve it. The house is on stilts, essentially, because Live Forward is moving it 12 feet from where it has sat for 116 years to make room for a new apartment complex on the property. Live Forward Development bought the property in June 2023 and plans to build roughly 100 workforce housing units, which are intended to complement the home's historic aesthetic. The 12-foot shift will create enough space for the company to add the complex to the lot while still reusing the historic home. The building's previous owner sought to tear down the home, leading Phoenix's Historic Preservation Office to get involved. In February 2024, the Phoenix City Council voted to approve a $400,000 grant for the development company to relocate the home and adapt it to a commercial or restaurant space. The project also got a $324,000 grant from the state. 3 weeks ago, the process of moving the home began. With the help of craftsmen with expertise in lifting historic homes, the house was lifted onto the high beams, lifted again with hydraulics, and then put on wheels. Scott Kilkenny, a founding member of Live Forward, said the moving process took 2 weeks to ensure that the structure was stabilized. There was a real concern that they might crumble, he said. Last Wednesday, the house was moved to where it currently sits, on the southeast corner of the lot. However, the home is not yet in its final resting place. The developers are now working to create a new foundation and bring in the utilities to the northwest corner of the lot. When that's done, which is expected sometime in September, the home will be placed on the corner of 3rd Avenue and McKinley Street. Then, the next stage of the project will begin. Developers plan to restore the structure's exterior to how it was originally built, Kilkenny said, but they'll transform and modernize the interior into a food and beverage concept, or some sort of community center. A garden patio may hang off the backside of the building. It'll be a really cool hangout spot, Kilkenny said. Some parts of the house will have to be replaced. The house was abandoned for a long time, Kilkenny said, and birds, rodents, and people doing some criminal activity in the home meant a lot of cleanup was required. The wood shingle roof will have to be replaced completely. Live Forward is going for the same appearance and facade feel, but due to modern building codes and fire safety concerns, the wood roof will have to go, Kilkenny said. But the arched windows, columns, and brick facade will look as it did originally. While the ultimate purpose of the space is to be determined, whatever the home ends up becoming will join an increasing number of restaurants, coffee shops, and businesses in the area. The historic Gold Spot, with favorites like Lola Coffee and First and Last, is just a month away. New and incoming spots like Proof Bread and Matilda's All Day Cafe are just a quick walk away. Here's one more story for this week's program, written by TJ LeHeru and posted on June 6th. Enraged man berates and fights cop after traffic stop, gets shot. The Phoenix Police Department shoots a lot of people, especially compared to other similarly sized departments. But one surefire way to catch a bullet in Phoenix or elsewhere is to pick a fight with a cop. That's what 46-year-old Sam Perrone did, according to body-worn camera footage released by the department on Friday. After being pulled over in a traffic stop in North Phoenix on May 25th, Perrone yelled aggressively at a Phoenix police officer before squaring up and attacking him. After a tussle, Perrone wound up with a bullet in one of his legs and was arrested and criminally charged. Friday, the Phoenix Police Department released a critical briefing incident about the shooting. The department's briefings are narrated by officers and made public after any police shooting or in-custody death. They typically include a limited selection of dispatch audio and body-worn camera footage. The video shows Perrone immediately getting confrontational with the cop who pulled him over, identified by the department as Michael Ugalde Flores. The veins in Perrone's neck and biceps pop as he screams at Ugalde Flores for 4 minutes, calling Ugalde Flores a motherfucker, a punk-ass bitch, and saying fuck you or fuck your mother at least 26 times. After radioing for backup, Ugalde Flores ultimately pushed Perrone back and asked him to keep his distance, only for Perrone to respond with a sidearm slap before dropping into full fighting form a la Mortal Kombat. Though Ugalde Flores lost his body-worn camera in the ensuing scrap, cell phone footage taken by a witness during the fight shows the officer brawling with Perrone before shooting him. Phoenix Police Sergeant Brian Bauer said Ugalde Flores fired at Perrone once, hitting him in the leg. Perrone was taken to a hospital and treated before being booked in jail. Perrone was the fourth person this year to be shot by Phoenix police. The other three died. Phoenix police shot and killed 14 people last year and 12 in 2023, both up from 10 in 2022. Fuck you, fucking fuck. According to the footage released by police, Ugarte Flores pulled Perone over near Cactus Road and 25th Place for allegedly traveling 30 miles per hour in a 40 mile per hour zone, and possibly making too many stops. In Arizona, driving too slowly is grounds for a traffic stop and citation. Perone was immediately hot about the stop. Body cam footage shows that when Ugarte Flores approached Perone's vehicle, Perone was already standing outside it. Pretty quickly, his anger went from 0 to 100. "Why are you following me, motherfucker?" Perone asked. "I'm not following you," Ugarte Flores responded. "Yeah, you fucking are," Perone screamed. For several minutes, Perone went on a verbal rampage against Ugarte Flores, again asking him why he pulled him over, demanding that he call his supervisor to the scene, and refusing to provide his driver's license. Ugarte Flores repeatedly said why he'd made the stop, and that he had radioed for a superior, and that he required Perone's identification. "Sir, there is no need to yell. I need your driver's license," Ugarte Flores said. "Fuck you, fucking fuck. I'm a fucking knock. Ow!" Perone screamed incoherently before collecting himself. "You're fucking illegal as fuck right now, kid, and you know you are." He also accused Ugarte Flores of stalking him before saying, "Your dick's all tiny and shit, and everybody knows it." In a serious understatement, Ugarte Flores said softly into his radio that Perone was, quote, "unhappy." Perone then finally provided his name, but refused to provide his birthday. "What's your birthday?" Perone demanded from the cop. "You don't need my birthday," Ugarte Flores said. "Fuck you, you don't need to know my shit," Perone fired back. According to court documents, Perone posted bail on Friday and was released pending trial. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Please stay tuned for additional interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawwell.